Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, November 8th, 2009, and this is show number 232. Got a fun-filled show for today, so let's just dig right in. So by now you've probably all forgotten about BlogWorld and New Media Expo, but I haven't because I keep learning things when I comb through my notes. I've got a few more tidbits coming. This will be a quick one because I just reread some notes and remembered that Victor Cahiao and George Starcher threw out yet another tidbit in their high-end audio podcasting pitch. The piece I remembered was where to find free sound sources, jingles, and other audio files you can use for free. They had three sources, but I could only find two of the three they listed. The first one was the Free Sound Project at freesound.org. Here's their tagline. The Free Sound Project is a collaborative database of Creative Commons licensed sounds. Free Sound focuses only on sound, not songs. Well, that sounds like a pretty good place to start checking things out. It didn't look like they had a lot of good categories and things like that, like, okay, here's bird sounds or here's door sounds or something like that, but I'm sure you can find what you need there. The second one is called SoundSnap from soundsnap.com. Their tagline is, not just a sound library. Choose from 100,000 sound effects and loops. SoundSnap only lets you have 5 sounds a month for free, though. Above that, you have to buy into a membership, and it's not cheap. $29 if you buy 1 month's worth. Cheaper if you buy more months of access in a row. Well, anyway, that's a quick tidbit from Blog World Expo. Well, in the last week or so, Twitter has started a new idea called Lists. As a Twitter user, you can create a list by name, and then you add people to that list. Now on the Twitter site, you can click on that list name and view the tweets from just that list of people. Let's say you're interested in someone's tweets. You might also be interested in who they've chosen to follow. And rather than just clicking, say, to see the hundreds in their follower list, you might want to narrow it down to just the subjects you're interested in. For example, I created a list called the Mac Roundtable. So if you want to follow all of the members on the Mac Roundtable on Twitter, it's easy to just click the link on my Twitter site and see what they're up to. That's not easy enough, though. How about taking it up a notch? If you go to podfeet.com, there's actually a nice little widget in the sidebar to read the tweets of the Mac Roundtable gang. Very cool. I also created a list called NoCillaCast Live, and that's a list of the people who join me every week during the live show and contribute in the chat room. It's a great bunch of people, and they're brilliant, of course, so you probably want to go view all of their tweets, too. I put the NoCillaCast Live listener in the sidebar at podfeet.com, too. You have to scroll down past the PayPal button, the ScreenSteps coupon, the Amazon affiliate link, and all of the ways to subscribe, but you'll find it down there eventually. If you come to the live show and you'd like to be added to the list, be sure to @tweet me so I get your Twitter name in that list. Let's get started here with a review on the Magic Mouse by Matt.
Hey, Allison, this is Matt Hillier from the Stealth Mac Podcast, back again this week to do a review for you. And this week I'm going to do a review of Apple's Magic Mouse. Now, when Apple updated their store on October 20th, they quietly released updates to their iMac and MacBook lines, and they also released a new mouse and remotes. And after watching the new iMac video with Johnny Ive demonstrating the new mouse, I just couldn't resist clicking on the purchase button from the Apple online store. The mouse arrived on Friday, October 30th, and I've been using it ever since. So let's give you a little history first before we talk about Apple's new mouse. The previous mouse I had was the Apple Bluetooth Mighty Mouse. The mouse was white, shiny, reminded me sort of an elongated hockey puck. The mouse had 4 touch-sensitive buttons. They were left, right, center, and the sides. Think squeeze here. They could be programmed for anything in the OS X system preference pane, but for me they were left and right click. The center was the button to invoke the dashboard, and squeezing, or pushing the side buttons, was to evoke expose. The mouse also had a ball on the top forward center that was used for scrolling. This ball was the crowning point and at the same time the downfall for this mouse. The ball allowed for 360-degree scrolling, up, down, left, right. So you could scroll through those long spreadsheets, or, my favorite, scrubbing the timeline in Final Cut. A lot of other mice just didn't have the left-right scroll ability. So the problem with the ball, though, is the same problem that every other mouse has with a ball in it. Eventually, dirt and debris collect on the motion detector rollers that cause the little scroll ball to cease functioning. A little aggressive cleaning upside down on the lint-free cloth would sometimes help, but over time the ball would just become less and less responsive. The downfall here is that there's no way to get the ball out to clean the detectors. So once it's jammed full, there's no way to get it clean unless you break the mouse apart to get the ball in the rollers. Now, this isn't too hard to do. In fact, I did this to my first Mighty Mouse. Now Apple calls it the Apple Mouse. But after I put it together, it just never really worked quite the same again. So I ended up purchasing a second mouse. So there's the problem. But now for the solution. The solution is, of course, the new Apple Magic Mouse. Yes, Apple changed the name due to a recent court awarding the Mighty Mouse trademark to another company that Apple did not have a previous agreement with. So Apple had to rename its mouse. The Magic Mouse is the same length as the Mighty Mouse was, but about half the height. And honestly, it reminds me of a Dove soap bar in size and shape. The bottom is the brushed aluminum that Apple has recently grown fond with. There is a switch to turn the power on and off, and speaking of power, the mouse uses two AA batteries that are included with the purchase. The tracking engine has also been improved over the previous model, and from what I have seen, it is much more precise at tracking movements than the previous Mighty Mouse was. There are no buttons on the mouse. Its surface is smooth plastic. You can left and right click like the traditional mouse. To scroll, just use your finger to brush on the top of the mouse in the direction you want to scroll. It even uses the inertial technique that the iPhone had, where you flick the finger quickly and it'll scroll down the page or it'll scroll up the page really fast. The scrolling is smooth and it's much better than anything the Mighty Mouse had to offer. You can also use two-finger swipe to go forward or backward through web pages or in photos in iPhoto or Aperture. With this feature, I have some issues because there's no real easy way for me to hold the mouse still and flick it. See, I've got big hands and long fingers, and if I follow what's shown on the video in the preference pane, which recommends using your palm to hold it, my fingers extend several inches past the top of the mouse. While I find this gesture nice to have, I think it kind of fails on actual usability, at least in my case. Also, when right-clicking, you must do it with only one finger resting on the top of the unit. If, say, you use one finger to left-click and another finger to right-click while leaving the opposite finger resting on the top of the mouse, the click will not register. I hope that makes sense. Let's talk about installation. Just like every other Apple product, when you turn on the mouse, it'll show up and work. It appears in the Bluetooth preference pane. You choose it, and that's about it. But for right now, to enable the scrolling gestures, you need to run the system update and download the mouse drivers from Apple. I ran system update beforehand. The drivers weren't there. After I put the mouse on the Bluetooth preference pane and got it working, the drivers automatically showed up in the preference pane. The mouse drivers do require a reboot, so be prepared. As for losing the two extra buttons, I'm really not heartbroken about the dashboard button. I rarely use the dashboard anyway, but I am saddened over the loss of the button to invoke Exposé. Now, this is a feature that I use quite frequently. So to get around this, I've created a bottom left corner as a hot corner to invoke Exposé, and it works quite well. Overall, the mouse is what you'd expect from Apple. Yes, this statement is worded the way I have on purpose. See, I found that within the Mac community, there are two camps. Ones that love the Apple mouses, and others that hate it. Well, if you hate it, you're probably going to hate this one too, and you'd be happier with your MX Revolution or whatever alternative you've found. But for those who actually liked the Mighty Mouse, you'll find that using the Magic Mouse is really a step up. It feels better in the hand, the scrolling and tracking are much more accurate, and with the loss of the two extra buttons as a pain, there are rumors that maybe Apple will have something up their sleeve in the 10.6.2 update, or I'm sure it won't be long before some innovative third-party developer makes a control panel. I've provided Allison with the Apple Store link for her show notes, as well as pictures of my Magic Mouse unboxing, as any true geek would do, and hopefully she'll provide those in the show notes. My name is Matt Hillier. I'm with the Stealth Mac Podcast. You can find me at thestealthmac.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at BLDNGNERD. Thanks, Allison.
Well, you're right about that love-hate thing about the mice from Apple, Matt. That's for sure. I know people who just swear by them, and I know a lot of people are just like, that's the first thing I take out of the box, put it right into the drawer full of extra old stuff, is the mouse from Apple. But it sounds like they're going to keep trying. This new Magic Mouse is certainly getting a lot of attention. I know my son Kyle has already put it on his Christmas list, so we'll see how that goes for him. One of the reasons I asked the lovely people who created ScreenSteps if I could advertise with them was because I had struggled to use Microsoft Word to create documentation. I'm an animal when it comes to finding and using screen snapshot tools like Jing and Sketch and all manner of Windows and Mac tools. But in the end, if I wanted to write anything of substance, I had to paste those pictures into Word. And then the misery began. Have you ever tried to get text to wrap around an image using Word? It's not that Word can't do it, it's just that the behavior is entirely unpredictable. You think you've finally got that little picture of the dog set just right so your text will wrap around it, and then you try to move the image just a smidge, and bam, suddenly the image jumps to the end of your Word document. Ah, it drives me crazy. There were a lot of tears shed when I used to struggle with this. And then along came ScreenSteps, which takes away from me the burden of how the text and images blend together. ScreenSteps makes step headings for me. I can preset how I want them to look, and then puts the text to the side or below the image depending on my preferences for that document. Makes nice little footers and headers, creates a lovely table of contents, basically relieving me of doing all the mundane and non-value-added tasks, and leaves me to the heavy lifting of thinking about what I'm trying to teach and how best to explain things in words and pictures. If this sounds good to you, head over to ScreenSteps.com and download the free trial and give it a spin. And when you can't resist buying ScreenSteps, be sure to use the coupon code NOSILLA for 25% off your purchase price. That's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
What do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
William writes in with a quintessential example of a dumb question. The question that seems obvious that everybody else would know the answer to, but I bet there's people like you who don't know the answer. Here's what he wrote. Hello, this is William from upstate New York with a dumb question. What is Flash and why doesn't it work on the iPhone? I also wanted to mention that I am legally blind and I'm a diversity advocate specializing in the etiquette for working with people with disabilities in corporate America. I greatly appreciate the enthusiasm you have allowed to come through from your disabled viewers. October was National Disability Awareness Month, so the timing of some of your recent segments was perfect. Well, you know, William, when I first started podcasting, I just did it so I could stop bothering my friends with all this tech geek stuff that interests me and try to find other people who did care about what I was talking about. I had no idea that I would actually make a difference in some people's lives like this. I'm in awe of what strides people are making with technology today, especially those with disabilities. For example, I read an article recently about a woman with autism who can't hold a normal conversation, can't ride the bus, can't shop, certainly doesn't have a job, but she found her voice in blogging and she's been explaining her life that way. It's astounding what technology can do. Anyway, on to your question. I think it's perfect for Dumb Question Corner because it's one of those things that seems like everyone else already knows what the answer is, so how can you figure it out this late in the game? Well, only if you have enough courage to ask the dumb question, that's how. All right, Flash is a confusing term on its best day. Flash is a technology to create applications which display animated imagery on a website. But it's also a video container, so it's two entirely different things. So let's break it down one by one. As a way to animate images, it allows a developer to create things like games that react to mouse clicks on a website. This is the functionality that does not work on the iPhone. The reason behind why is a question you really have to ask Apple. It's because they've refused to enable it on the iPhone. It hasn't actually been common to have Flash work on any mobile phones, but more recently Adobe has created Flash Lite, which works on mobile phones if the handset manufacturer supports it. I found a link to a site at Adobe where they list all of the handset manufacturers that support Flash Lite, and I put that link in the show notes. I did some searches, and a lot of the biggies aren't on that list. RIMS BlackBerry, HTC, and Motorola are not on the list, but Nokia, the king of handsets, has 94 devices that support Flash Lite. Okay, so that's the Flash that does animated stuff on websites. Now for the second half of the lesson, Flash as a video container. Now I've talked about this a few times, but it's kind of a weird topic, so let me go over the basics again. Video is very confusing because there are containers and there are codecs. A codec means coder-decoder, so that's the technology that encodes a video on the creator's end and then decodes it when the user wants to play it. Codecs are really, really specific. But containers, can contain many different types of codecs. All right, have I lost most of the audience here yet? Either through boredom or confusion, either way? Well, let me give an example of a symptom you've lived through that is because of what I'm saying. Someone sends you an AVI file, and it plays fine. Someone else sends you an AVI file, and it won't play. The AVI is the container, but the first and second AVI files contain different codecs. So for one codec, you had the right decoder, but you didn't have the decoder for the second one. All right, why am I talking about containers and codecs and all this nonsense? Well, when the iPhone first came out, it had a YouTube application, but you couldn't play very many YouTube videos. That's because the iPhone can play the H.264 codec inside a flash video container. Over the last couple of years, YouTube has been re-encoding all of the movies in YouTube to H.264, so that's why more and more videos play on the iPhone. So technically, you could say that Flash does play on the iPhone, as long as it's a movie and it's encoded with H.264. But if you talk about Flash, where it's like little animations and stuff like that, it doesn't play on the iPhone. So I would say your question wasn't dumb at all, William, because what is Flash? It's two different things. So Jim Sewell, who is also known as @Deverill, D-E-V-E-R-I-L-L on Twitter, you remember the guy that makes me think of him every single time I put only one headphone in on my iPod now? Anyway, he asked another dumb question. Hi, Allison. If you have a link handy, fire it off in email and use this for dumb questions. Otherwise, here's a dumb question for your show whenever you get time for it. As a relatively new Mac switcher, I gotta know, where can I go find free applications, must-have applications, apps that are not necessarily free but are cream of the crop? It could be one super site or a few separate ones, but I find myself hearing about something on podcasts that I never thought to go looking for, which makes me Google uselessly for this purpose. Right now, podcasts like yours are where I find out about new apps, but I'm sure there's collections somewhere that I can just browse through and say, oh, cool, I never thought about that. Max rule. Thanks, Allison. You're still the best, in case you were wondering. Well, thanks, Jim. I appreciate the vote of confidence there. This is a tough question, but I may actually go along with your answer to the question. Today, I find out about most of my freeware shareware app ideas from podcasts. If I hear someone talk about an application in a favorable way, I'm more likely to download that application than any other random app. Now, that doesn't help you, though, if you're hunting for an application to solve a specific problem. One place I used to go before I had more than I could hunt for was Version Tracker at versiontracker.com. In there, it auto-senses that you're looking for Mac software if you go there on a Mac, or it switches to the PC if you're on Windows. I think it has some Linux, but I won't swear to that. So you go in with the operating system of choice, or you can hit a tab to switch to the one you want, and do a search for a term like, say, image editing, and it'll show you all of the applications with that term in their description. Next to each one, it'll tell you if it's freeware, shareware, or commercial, meaning big bucks, or if it's still in beta. You can see the product rating in 1 to 5 stars, and you can see how many downloads there have been for that particular product. Oh, great. Thanks a lot, Jim. Because of you, I ended up downloading yet another image editor, because I was in there poking around a Version Tracker to tell you about it. I'd never heard of the Seashore Project. That's an application based on the GIMP, which is an open-source image editor that's really rough around the edges. But this application has 19,000 downloads and 5 out of 5 stars, so it's got to be good. I lost 20 minutes of time I should have been writing up the show notes. Well, if that is not an indication that Version Tracker is useful, or at least time-wasting and dishogging, I don't know what is. Version Tracker even lets you filter down the options by what version of OS X you're running. So let's say you're on Jaguar or Panther or Tiger, you won't get teased by applications that don't run on your machine. A lot of people swear by a site called IUseThis at IUseThis.com. This is a site that uses voting to get the most used applications to the top of the heap. I typed in image editor and I got a list of applications, first sorted by relevance to my query, but I can also sort by the number of users who have declared that they use it, and a third option where you can sort by most interesting. Not sure how they decide what's most interesting, maybe they just their choice. Sorting this list by users pulled to the top Pixelmator, which is a great higher-priced shareware application, $58, but next up is our new toy, Seashore, that I was just telling you about. For some reason, Mars Edit got in the pile, though, even though it's a text editor, but after that is Acorn, which was one of my new favorites for image editing. I'm going to do a review on that in this very show. As you gain followers who are Mac geeks on Twitter, they can be a great source of answers too. So you could tweet, what's the best application for the Mac to do blah, blah, blah for, say, under around $40? If you got enough people following you, you'll get some new and unexpected answers. One way to get a pile of applications that may or may not fit your needs is to participate in something like Mac Heist. The idea is that you give them some money, usually around 70 bucks or so, and they give you a big fat bundle of applications. You don't know up front which applications you're going to get, because in theory, they don't unlock all of the applications in the bundle until the game is over. But in reality, they unbundle all of them every time anyway. I have voiced my concerns that this seems like a bit of a, I don't want to say scam, but I mean, it seems kind of weird because they get people to annoy each other by advertising for them on Twitter to say, come on, join in so that I can get this cool application next. But they're going to give you all the apps anyway, so it's really sort of fake. But all that aside, you do get a couple of crazy cool applications, a few unusual applications you might not have thought of, and then some goofy little things that maybe you'll never use, but you might find a use for them eventually. My personal habit is to buy in and then forget to launch most of them. If you don't have a gigantic filled applications folder, though, this would be a really good way to get introduced to some big, medium, and small shareware vendors. The guys in the chat room were just mentioning that, what was the application they just said? Wiretap was one in the last bundle. Wiretap Studio is what I use for recording my chit-chat across the pond with Bart, so that was a great pull for sure. Anyway, this year they're making me nuts. The Mac Heist guys are making me crazy because I can't log in. I've had them reset my password twice, and it doesn't work. So, I don't know, maybe they heard me complaining about their sales practices last year. But anyway, check out Mac Heist. That's a good way to go. One of the best podcasts to learn about new tools is the Mac ReviewCast at MacReviewCast.com. Every week or so, Tim Verporten goes over what freeware's been updated, being pretty selective to only mention the good stuff. Then people like me and about 10 other contributors will review software and tell you what we thought of it. We don't always like what we try, so sometimes you might actually find out what not to buy in a particular piece of software. I hope that helps you out, Jim, and you can always write to me and say, I want to do this, what's the best application to solve that problem? And I'll try to find some good alternatives for you. If anyone listening has a suggestion for Jim on where he can find good software, send me an email or a recording telling us how you find quality applications for the Mac and for Windows. Next up, we've got a great review by Evan on the subject of night camera.
Hi, Allison and No Silicast listeners. It's Evan from Colorado coming at you with another review of a great iPhone app. This week's app is Night Camera by Suitability. Let's start with a potential problem. The iPhone camera is not great, and any camera movement yields blurry photos, especially in dark environments. Enter Night Camera. To sum it up, Night Camera is an app that uses an accelerometer in your iPhone to sense when your phone is completely still, then takes the picture. Okay, let's get into it a bit deeper. There are three modes you can set the app into. The first is standard. This allows the app to function just as the standard camera app on your iPhone as far as when the picture is taken. When you tap the shutter button, the picture is taken right then and there, no matter if you are moving or not. The second mode is stable, which is the mode that uses the accelerometer to trigger the shutter as soon as your phone is held still. You tap the shutter button and you see a little scale with green dots. The fewer the number of dots, the more stable your phone is. And when all the dots vanish, the picture is taken. This yields the best results, obviously, since the picture will only be shot when the phone is held still. The third mode is timer. This allows you to set a timer for when you want to take the picture after you tap the shutter button. You have the option of 1, 5, 10, 15, 30, or 60 seconds. When set in stable mode, you get several options. The first is how sensitive the sensor is. This refers to the level of movement or lack thereof that is required to fire the shutter. You also get the option to have the shutter automatically start sensing when the app is launched. If this is turned off, you have to tap the shutter button, then wait for the phone to remain still. There's also the option to set a delay before it will start sensing the movement after you tap the shutter button. I'm not really sure why this would be useful, so I just leave it off, but I guess it's there if you want. There are a few other options that this app has. There's the option to change the photo ratio, normal or wide, and the option to change the resolution to 1600 by 1200 or native 640 by 480. There's the option to change how the photo is processed, meaning color, black and white, sepia, or hard light. There's also the fantastic option to make the whole screen the shutter button, meaning instead of tapping the relatively small button at the bottom of the screen, dedicated as the shutter, you can tap anywhere on the screen and it will be the same. This is nice, say, if you're trying to take a picture of you with a group of friends. You hold the phone out in front of you and the screen is facing away from you. You can just tap anywhere instead of trying to find that tiny button on the touch screen. Now comes one of my favorite parts of Night Camera. There's the option to zoom in by up to 4 times. If this is enabled, you just swipe right across the screen to zoom in and swipe left to zoom out. Obviously, this is using digital zoom, so the quality does go down significantly, especially when zoomed in beyond about 2 times. The quality looks horrendous in the preview, but after you actually take the picture, it renders properly and the quality improves a lot. It actually looks pretty good if you ask me, although it's not as good as if you hadn't zoomed at all. The other options are to display grid lines on the screen, autosave the pictures you take into the camera roll, the option to put a timestamp on your photos, and the option to make your phone vibrate when you snap the picture. That's about it. It's a really simple app that I have now replaced the default camera app on my iPhone with. At least in my experience, I've been able to get much better shots, especially in situations where there may be low light. It also allows me to zoom in and get a bit closer to things that are maybe just a bit far away. Night Camera is available in the App Store for 99 cents, and I gave Allison the iTunes link, which I'm sure she'll put in the show notes. To find out more about what I do, you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/vanmo92.
Well, thanks, Evan. It sure does sound like the folks at Suitability put an awful lot of capability into a 99-cent application. By the way, do you realize how much your 99-cent-at-a-time application reviews are costing me, though? I clicked buy as soon as I was done hearing your review. Jeez. Talk to my checkbook. Well, when we were at Blog World and New Media Expo, Darren McClure, also known as Darren R. McClure on Twitter, from rtgit.com, that's rtgit.com, asked me if I knew of a good microphone for the iPhone or iPod Touch. I found out about a small mic called the Brando Flexible Mini Capsule Microphone from brando.com, and I asked them for a review unit. This is a teeny tiny little mic about the size of the last joint of your pinky. It's simply a little domed cylinder with a mic, three-ring iPhone mini jack sticking out of it. The mic can point straight up, but more practically, you want to point it 90 degrees so you can have it point forward or backward. I suppose you could also save it, have it point side to side, too, if you liked. Well, Steve tested it with the iPod Touch that doesn't have a built-in microphone at all, and he was very happy to finally be able to create video or audio voice notes, further narrowing the gap between the iPhone and the iPod Touch. Now to the real point, how does it sound? Well, I tricked Steve into doing some recordings for me on my iPhone to test it out. Both of the recordings you're about to hear were using the Voice Memo app on the iPhone. I stood with the iPhone about a foot away from him for the first half, and then 5 feet away from him for the second half. Here are the two recordings.
This is the built-in mic close-up. Hi, this is the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com. Built-in mic far away. Hi, this is the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com. This is the Brando Flexible Mini Capsule Microphone close-up. Hi, this is the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com. This is the Brando Flexible Mini Capsule Microphone at far distance. Hi, this is the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com.
As you can hear, the built-in mic sounds fantastic up close, but it doesn't pick up a lot of audio when you're far from your subject. The Brando Mini Capsule mic is sort of the opposite. It's pretty rough up close, but when you get 5 feet away, it picks up the sound much better than the built-in mic. The sound is a little bit hot, I hear a bit of hiss, but I think it's a good trade-off for the gain you get. What I would do is I wouldn't use it for close-up recording, but I would when somebody's far away. I tested the Brando when I had a case on my iPhone, and it got this click, click, click sound throughout the recording. So you do have to make sure the mic is plugged in all the way before you do it. So I took the case off, and it worked fine. One other small oddity is that when the Brando is plugged into the iPhone / iPod Touch, you can't hear anything out of the speakers. So for example, when the Voice Memo application gives you a little beep to tell you it started the recording, you're not going to hear it. You'll have to rely on the visuals to tell you that it started recording. The Brando Flexible Mini Capsule Microphone is only $14. The size and weight are essentially zero, and the cost is practically zero, so you can throw this in your bag and have it with you all the time. Of course, you'll never be able to find it because it's so small. Now, when you run into that situation where you wish you had your Zoom H2 with you, but you just don't have it, you'll have your Brando mic and be able to conduct a good interview. I recommend the Brando Flexible Mini Capsule Microphone from Brando.com. The one thing I'd suggest they do is actually put their name on it, maybe in little white letters or something, because a month from now, I'm not going to remember who made this, and there's nothing on it, nothing you can see. So anyway, check out the Brando Flexible Mini Capsule from Brando.com. Actually, I'm going to add one more thing. When I stopped to chat with the live chat room at podfeed.com/live, I looked and I think there are some letters on it, but they're black on black and it's just barely raised. So if I were them, I'd spend a little time with some white paint or something like that. So anyway, it does technically have its name, and I suppose with a microscope or possibly someone under 50, you could probably read that. When I was creating my presentation and keynote for Blog World Expo, I wanted to create a really classy and simplistic look, a dark gray background with stark images to convey my message. I didn't want a bunch of words for people to read. I wanted vivid pictures to tell the story. I started hunting online for the pictures I wanted, or using big icons for the applications I was talking about and using them in keynote. Invariably, there was something not just right about the image. Either the crop was too broad, or the image had a transparent background when I wanted it white, or maybe I needed to just change the image a little bit, erased a word that was on it, or something like that. I could have installed Photoshop Elements, which I've been upgrading each year for nearly, I think it's about $80 a year, and I've always been behind Windows, the Windows version anyway, even at that kind of money. I could have done that and waited 35 seconds for the application to launch, because evidently it has to fetch its library parts from, I don't know, Zimbabwe. Okay, no offense, Zimbabwe. It just, you sound as far away as I could think of and still be on the same planet. Or I could simply launch the new Acorn 2 from Flying Meat at flyingmeat.com. The logo for Acorn says, "The Image Editor for Humans." And I really feel like that describes this great tool. I used it throughout that project, and it was just perfect. It just fit that niche exactly what I needed. Perhaps my single favorite thing about Acorn is that it launches instantly. I do not have that anguish reaction when I realize, oh, I've accidentally launched Photoshop Elements. Oh, no, I got to go get coffee or something. Instead, I think, oh, cool, Acorn will help me with this, because it just snaps up. I mean, it's practically as fast as Quick Look, and that's fast. When Acorn opens an image, you can see in the bottom left the size of the canvas, which is something I'm always looking up on other image editors, and you have a lovely zoom slider. The tools palette comes up automatically, and it has the classic look of most image editors. Select, zoom, crop, move, brush, draw, and select are taking the top six spots. Select allows rectangular, with or without a corner radius of choosable size. You have a circular selection, freeform with straight edges, or a magic selection tool. The magic selection tool allows you to select a wand tolerance, which means how close the color has to be to what you clicked on before it's considered part of the same selection. What I couldn't find was a way to additively select like you can in Photoshop Elements. For example, I couldn't shift select, command select, or there wasn't any little icon to click on that I saw that would let you grab a bunch of non-contiguous areas at the same time. Could be in here somewhere, but I did not recognize it easily as being there. The selection tools worked well in my tests and had one cool visual feature I've not seen before in other image editors. You could show your selection using the traditional marching ants, or what they call view selection clipped out, which means after you make a selection, it grays out everything but what you've selected. A very interesting effect. One thing didn't work right for me on Acorn. Research assistant Niraj asked me to edit some images of Honda Bob for the new website he's building for Bob, and he wanted a nice rounded edge on the photos. I looked in Acorn's documentation, and they said you could crop using the selection rectangle with corner radius set. But this didn't work. It shows the selection as having a rounded corner, but when I select crop, the corner is sharp. I hope I'm just doing it wrong, but I did read a bit, and I didn't find any clarification that helped me out. I wrote to the people at Flying Meat and asked them about that, so hopefully they'll get back to me on that. The crop tool has presets like 2x3 and 3x5, but it doesn't come with the standard swap dimensions, upon which I've come to depend. The eraser tool is pretty sweet, though. It allows you to erase at a specific opacity and also to change it by how hard you press on a tablet. Nice stuff for them artsy-fartsy types like Crazy Listener James. Other artsy-fartsy elements include the gradient tool, which gives you a linear or radial gradient, and you can easily select the beginning and ending colors for it. One of the most valuable tools I use in editing photographs is the clone tool. You can use this to remove a blemish from a wall behind someone that's kind of distracting to the photo, or maybe fix a tear in an old photograph, or erase some kid floating in the water behind your family in a lovely beach scene. Acorn has the clone tool, and it also works on the pressure from a tablet if you have one of those. The drawing tools work nicely. Rectangles, ovals, and lines, all with fill options, corner radii. Not on the line, silly. On the oval and the rectangles. Actually, no, just on the rectangles. That wouldn't make sense either. You can also control stroke thickness with options to have the stroke dashed, and you can even define how long the dashes and how big the gaps between the dashes are. Acorn supports layers and layer blending options, too numerous to list off here. All right, not too numerous, but too boring to list off here. Speaking of numerous, there are 13 separate filter categories with about 7 options within each of those categories. I didn't go through them all, but the usual suspects are there, like Gaussian blur and unsharp mask, along with the usual weirdo ones like poster eyes. But there's a whole bunch in here that'll be good to while away the time on a long plane flight sometime. Once in a while, you might actually be creating some art. That is, if you have a right side to your brain. And along with cool filters, you also have some nice alignment tools for working with your layers. A tool I use a lot in any image editor is the Levels tool, which allows you to move sliders to compensate for lack of information at the high or low end of the light spectrum. A higher-end tool will allow you to move the sliders independently for red, green, and blue, but Acorn only works on all of them at once. In reality, I'm not that skilled at doing them independently, but you might be better at this than I am, so it might matter to you. I'm very, very happy with Acorn for most of my simple image editing projects where I don't want to wait the 45 minutes for Aperture to launch and then another 38 minutes for it to quit, but I just want to do some simple modifications and move along. I haven't reloaded Photoshop Elements on my machine since I installed Snow Leopard, and I don't think I will now that I have Acorn for the easy stuff and Aperture for the super advanced work. Now here's the best part. Acorn is only $50. And an upgrade, if you own a previous version, is only $20. And if you bought the old one on or after July 2nd of this year, your upgrade is free. Now, compare that to what I've spent on Photoshop Elements for a nearly equivalent tool. Acorn wins hands down here for ease of use, versatility, speed of opening, and price. Good job, Flying Meat. If you're thinking about buying a car, and you live in the LA or Orange County areas of California, I better not hear about you buying anything but a Honda or maybe an Acura. If you do buy something else, do not come whining to me with something, you know, do you know a Toyota Bob? Because Honda Bob is the one and only. He's the only one who will come to your house, fix your car, or do scheduled maintenance to keep it running perfectly, and tell you bad jokes while he's there. He's the only one who will always tell you the truth about the state of your car and never upsell you on repairs you don't need while telling you bad jokes. He's the only one who cleans up after himself and tells bad jokes while he's showing you how he can even replace a transmission in your driveway. So when you buy your next car, new or used, make sure it's a Honda or an Acura and then give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, Honda Worldwide. Okay, while I was reading that ad, the goofballs in the chat room started going off. Let's see, I think Evan started it with Toyota Tom. Stu suggested Ford Fred. Evan said Chrysler Chris. Bonnyface said Subaru Sam. Big in Virginia said Nissan Neil. Let's see, Zach said Subaru Sam. Oh, wait, that's twice. We had Subaru Sam twice. Oh, Stu Helm, Land Rover Larry. Uh-oh, we had one that was censored. Audi Audrey. We have, that was from Paul Shadwell, Bonnyface, Aston Martin Aaron, Chevrolet Susie from Mark Shepard, Frank Ferrari from Bonnyface, Fiat Fred from Big in Virginia, BMW Bertrand. I mean, they just kept going. They even sucked me into it. Evan said Volkswagen, and I suggested Volkswagen Vinny. Then Bonnyface said Porsche Paul. This got out of control. We got Reliant Robin from Stu Helm, Jeep Jeffrey from Bonnyface, Odie Adam from Mac for Life. Okay, Mercedes. That's a good one, Bonnyface. Corvette, Corey. All right, that's enough. We're done. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How are you today, Bart?
I'm better than I was last week, but still not right.
You did an admirable job last week, considering how sick you were. We listened to it today. You sounded great.
Yeah, I think I'd just taken a Lemsip, so it was on a high of paracetamol or something. Well, the next morning I was really, really, really bad enough to the doctor. And yes, I had another chest infection and grr.
Something about living in damp, moldy air, I would think.
It can't help, really, no.
I think you need to move to California. That would help.
Certainly weather-wise.
Yeah, right.
I'm not sure about your health care, though.
Okay, let's not go down that whole road. So what do we have on the docket today?
First off, lots of follow-ups. We seem to have inspired people, which is nice. So first off, a little one from Stephen Hoots, which I am sure is a Belgian or Dutch name. Has to be.
There they are again. They're everywhere.
Yeah, no one else puts an O and an E and a T and a Z in that order. Anyway, he says, you were slightly inaccurate on the NosillaCast. AOL is not an Apple spin-off. It was a partnership between Quantum and Apple. And I stuck a Wikipedia entry into the show notes, which has a full sordid history of AOL and their many various names before they were AOL.
So, he was right?
He was right. They weren't called AOL before Apple were involved, and they weren't really AOL when Apple was involved. It's all very confusing, actually. I now know less than I did before I started.
Okay. So you can say you were wrong, but you can't say what is right. That sounds good.
There was a relationship between Apple and AOL. They are not innocent.
All right, good. What's next?
The other one then I got was from listener Paul from Peru, who said, Bart, just a quick note. There is an option in Mail under the mailbox menu that says, use this mailbox as, then you can select trash, sent, etc. You must have non-local mailbox selected for this option to be available. So in theory, then, if I find out whatever one Thunderbird likes to use as trash, I can then find it in Mail, set the option to tell Mail that this is to be the trash folder, and then in theory the two will live happily ever after and not fight with each other.
So that was your... It wasn't really syncing, but having them be the same thing?
Exactly. If they both agree on what is the trash can, what is the sent folder, and what is the saved items folder, then you're in business.
Oh, great. So have you tried that yet?
No, because I've been sick and I haven't had the energy to... Actually, just merely getting out of bed has been more effort than it's been worth this week. I haven't done anything.
Ugh. But that sounds like it might help you out.
No, it definitely it should stop the bickering between the pair.
Now, I submitted one, but you don't think it's worthy of the notes, but I'm going to bring it up anyway because I have a microphone. I went through and I made I made four smart mailboxes for one of my email accounts. One, I made it be the Podfeet inbox, the Podfeet sent mail, Podfeet trash, and Podfeet junk. And now I have those four things in one flip down. And you could do that with your work mail and just work out of those smart mailboxes and you would have it all clustered together and you wouldn't be able to see your distracting play mail. But you thought it was stupid, huh?
But what about all the actual smart folders I have for doing actual smartness?
Oh.
And then how would I... If I then do that with all my stuff, then I end up with them just sort of ordered alphabetically, but then I still can't collapse them separate to each other.
Yeah, because there aren't folders inside smart mailboxes that I could find.
No, and the other thing is, this is the story of my life, but nested folders. It always comes back to nested folders with me, but my folder structure has nesting.
So nested folders are your theme, huh?
They are my theme, actually, it does seem, yeah. But no, they're a great way of organizing stuff. So, yeah, no, my folders are nested so that alerts go into folders inside a folder called alerts, depending on what type of alert they are and stuff.
But that's what amazes me, that you could tolerate iPhoto as long as you did, because that's why I didn't go to... I couldn't stand it, because it didn't have nested folders.
Yeah, but the idea of events made sense.
But they didn't have nested folders. Yeah, but it's some giant pile.
It's not a giant pile. They're all grouped by time, so you can scroll down and it tells you what year you're in.
Yeah, scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll. I mean, I've got probably more than 1,000 folders, I would guess.
Yeah, that was one thing that didn't bother me in iPhoto. Aperture was as good at dealing with events as iPhoto is, because Aperture's terrible at it. You load that view and it takes like 20 days while it goes and finds thumbnails and assembles things and...
Oh, I didn't even know there was an events area in there.
It's not called events, it's called old projects.
Ah.
But it does that same thing where you can scrub them and stuff like you can in iPhoto, only it's really inefficient and slow.
There you go. But I can be in complete control, make my little anal nested folders with dates and names in them.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually don't use that as much in Aperture. But there you go.
All right.
I'm weird.
Next up.
Next up, you had a follow-up.
Yes. I had a question for you. So we talked a lot about Wi-Fi security in hotspots like cafes and that sort of thing. And as I was doodling around and saying, oh, I'm perfectly safe because I've got secure mail going here. I'm all great. And then I popped open Transmit to submit a an image up to my website. And I realized my my website with GoDaddy is a shared hosting plan, and because I pay like $4 a month. And I realized I was not using SFTP, secure FTP. I was using regular old file transfer protocol. So I was not using a secure method. And I pinged you and said, uh-oh.
Yeah, I think you said, am I safe? And I said, no.
Yeah, I think that was your full it was actually that descriptive. Yeah, it was no. I said, if I use SFTP, am I safe? And you said,
yes.
And then I checked, and I can't use SFTP. I checked at GoDaddy, and it says, nope, you can't have SFTP.
Yeah, I don't get this at all. FTP is an absolutely ancient protocol, and it just does everything in plain text. So when you log into it, it's the server basically says, who are you? And then your client says, I'm such and such a user. Here's my username. And then the server says, that's great. Now, what's your password? And then your client says, here's my password. And all of this has gone completely unencrypted. So anyone sniffing your network in any way, which is easy to do, as we discussed in coffee shops and so forth, hotels, etc., can just see your password. So they can see your username, see your password, log into your FTP, upload a bunch of viruses, whatever they like, really, and just basically take over your website subtly so you don't notice.
Nice.
And you go around infecting people with nasty malware and stuff.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah.
But what's the logic behind, from what I could see, GoDaddy, and I don't know if they're representative, but it was because I'm using a shared hosting service. If I had a dedicated or a virtual dedicated, I could have SFTP. Is there some technical reason behind that?
To me, I think a lot of this is legacy. Many, many moons ago, and I literally mean a decade or two ago, you know, security and encryption was really hard in CPUs, which had like, you know, a megahertz. You know, forget about gigahertz. And nowadays, that's just not true anymore. There's no earthly reason not to encrypt stuff because our CPUs are so powerful that it's really no overhead to just do a little quick encryption on stuff. So I think it's a case that, well, it's always been done like this, so why change? I mean, that's just the way the world is. You know, get used to this insecurity, and I think it's disgraceful. I actually would almost go so far as to call it criminally negligent, but I'm not a lawyer, so I can't actually say that.
And you did not say that. Let the record show.
I did
show.
Not say that. But it's certainly my feeling on the matter is that it should be considered a crime to be. So just not to give a monkeys about your customer security at all, and just to ignore reality and just pretend that we still live in an innocent internet where there's no bad guys. Just keep pretending that and it'll be okay.
Yeah, right. All right, so I learned a lesson. As soon as you said that, I killed that connection and waited till I got home to do my FTPing.
Yeah, I just remembered we left something out of the show notes that we were meant to talk about today.
What's that?
Whatchamajigger, that secured thing for... You said you were going to talk to Bart about... Wi-Fi hotspot, hotspot shield.
Hotspot shield. Oh, my gosh. We forgot all about that. Yeah. So last week we talked on the show. We had a review of... Was it really? No, I think
sorry,
it was just
no, we
last
We talked
week.
The week before last, and then last week we got an email in from a listener with a very good review.
Right. So Hotspot Shield, to review, was essentially a free VPN service. So you could VPN through these guys and life would be beautiful. And was it free or really inexpensive?
Free.
Okay.
Well, free in terms of money.
Okay.
So, I mean, it is free. There's no doubt about that. And they do encrypt your traffic from the moment it leaves your computer to the moment it arrives at their servers, which is what a VPN does. The problem is what happens when it arrives at their servers. Some people don't think it's an issue, but what they do is they unencrypt your traffic and then insert their own ads, and then they make money that way. So these are people you're trusting with your security, and they edit your data on the way through, which is about as big of a security breach as I can think of. So do I trust someone whose business model is based off of messing with my privacy? I don't. Some people do. That's their call. But I find that very suspect that people are editing your data and in the name of security, and that's somehow meant to make you feel better.
But what kind of damage can they do? I mean, obviously they could do big damage to you, but why would they? I mean, that's their purpose, is to keep you using their service. I mean, I don't see how it's terribly nefarious. I mean, if it,
you
it
don't
says
pay
clearly.
Them.
Right.
You're not paying them. They're at the behest of advertisers. And so advertisers, I mean, may decide that they want only to stick their ad into stuff, of, you know, into certain types of content or whatever. So then they have to start reading your content and start profiling you and all sorts of stuff. I mean, all the incentives are...
You mean exactly like Google does every day?
Yeah, but they don't insert it into sites that aren't... The owner of the site hasn't decided to partner with Google. This is basically, they'll just stick their ads into anywhere, which also... could annoy content providers because
okay, but before you get into that, what you said was that they're gonna profile your web behavior and insert ads for you, which is precisely what Google's business model is. They look at what you're searching for and give you targeted ads based on that.
Yeah, but if
it's
you
identical.
Block Google's API, if you block Google's JavaScript stuff, then they're not doing very much to you.
Okay.
It to me, the concept of making money off of invading people's privacy and offering a privacy service like a VPN are just mutually exclusive, and I can't trust a company with those incentives that go completely against what their incentive should be.
So how is it invading my privacy?
It's a matter of trust. It's a matter of trust. If you're happy, if you take this reality on board and you're completely happy with it, then fantastic, free service.
Okay. It's not really a security issue necessarily.
Privacy issue, which is strongly related.
How?
There is a potential security issue as well. It's a little less clear cut. When you send your traffic through a VPN, it becomes unencrypted again once it leaves the VPN endpoint. And normally, if you VPN into your home machine, then it's coming from your home IP and there's no real sort of collection of goodies. But if you use a service like Hotspot Shield, everyone's traffic comes out, pours onto the internet from a few points where their exit nodes are. So if you were an attacker and you wanted to really get loads of data for very little effort, you just attack those endpoints.
Okay.
Hotspot Shield have gathered together all the information for you, waiting for you to take it from there, where it's all nice and together.
Okay. Is that a highly probable thing or a remotely probable?
It's not trivially, compared to hijacking someone on a Wi-Fi hotspot, it's quite difficult to do. But you always have to balance out difficulty with what the prize is. I mean, it's much more difficult to break into a bank than into my house, and yet they're more likely to break into a bank than into my house.
Right.
Am I making sense?
Oh, yeah.
So there are attacks you can do on the internet to basically inject yourself into someone else's router. There's a bunch of protocols for routing, and if you mess with those... you can literally see every bit of traffic that should be going to that router. You see it and then send it on to that router. So it's a man-in-the-middle attack. And if you did that against an endpoint for someone like Hotspot Shield, you would have gold dust, pay dirt.
Okay, but okay, here's from a security standpoint, here's a trade-off. I'm sitting in a coffee shop and I'm going to send my unencrypted clear text password for my transmit for FTP, or... I'm going to use Hotspot Shield to VPN to do that. Which is a higher security risk?
I would imagine the higher security risk would just to do it directly from the Wi-Fi hotspot.
Okay.
I think you would be safer to go through Hotspot Shield, but don't look at it as being, it's not Fort Knox.
Okay. But it's a level of security I don't have, and I'm not willing to pay $12 a month to have a real VPN service.
My personal inclination would be to just always keep your S's, mind your S's as it were, and just not use a VPN.
You mean, so don't FTP when you're at a coffee shop?
To be honest, that's not a problem I have because, I mean, you laugh at me for my dedicated server because it costs a lot of money in fairness. Mm-hmm. But one advantage is I don't have to worry about FTP.
Sure. But there is other traffic that maybe you would worry about if you were that you have, right?
You see, the thing is, I'd be worried if it wasn't going through HTTPS. This is why I ended up fretting so much over Twitter logins not being over HTTPS.
Right.
So, I don't know, VPNs are... they can make you feel safer than you are.
Hmm.
Because anything you encrypt through a VPN still comes out unencrypted at the endpoint and travels across all the rest of the internet unencrypted.
Okay.
So it's not actually a replacement for sticking that S into your mail client.
Okay. So you're not as excited about VPNs in general anyway.
They have their uses. The use of a VPN is to connect into somewhere and access in there safely. So to VPN okay. from your home into a corporation.
Okay. I got it.
That's what they're for. And they're really good for that. And they're very safe for that. Because at all points, it leaves your laptop, it's encrypted all the way till it makes it into your corporate environment.
Okay. Now I'm with you.
Yeah. So it's as if you're in the corporation, effectively.
Sure.
That's what they're for.
Well, believe it or not, we haven't started Security Light yet. But I'm glad you remembered that.
If I put this in the show notes, I would have got my thoughts together into a coherent.
No, that's fine. I'm glad you remembered, at least. Forgetting that would have been lame.
Well, especially after we made a big deal of promising we would.
Exactly. All right, so Security Light.
Security Light. First up, next Tuesday is Patch Tuesday.
So Let's have a Patch Tuesday party.
Yeah, are they as much fun as, Windows 7 parties?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe I should, we could make a little party pack for that.
Lame videos on the internet? No?
Exactly. That would actually be really funny to do a spoof on that and have it be a Patch Tuesday party. All right, what are we expecting? Any excitement?
We're expecting 6, which is quite a small number compared to 18 last time.
Yeah.
4 for Windows, 2 for Office. 5 of them are remote code execution, though.
Yay.
So it's not many, but they are severe.
So one of our party games could be the remote code execution game, right?
Can you hack your friends?
No, you said 2 for Office. Are any of those for Mac Office, or is it just Windows Office?
I don't find it easy to tell. I've stuck a link in the show notes. See if you can make sense of it, you'd like. But the easy one is the executive summary, which breaks it down into 6 total, 4 Windows, 2 Office.
Okay. All right.
5 remote code execution.
So fire up your your virtual machines.
On Wednesday.
Right.
I think is it noon? Is it noon Western Pacific time or something?
Oh, who knows when noon is?
Yeah, it is a specific time on Tuesday, but for us in Ireland, it works out as worry about it on Wednesday.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know what way it'll work out for you guys in the States.
All right.
So if you use till Wednesday, it's definitely going to be out. Then Sun Microsystems have released a big update to Java. Everyone who's not a Mac user should update their JVM, and Mac users should pray, because that's all they can do.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we're back into this usual cycle. Sun update Java, Apple do nothing, and we wait. Last time it was 3 months. We'll see how we got this time.
Okay.
Then the giant big earth-shattering news, which is probably going to actually make it onto real television news because it's so serious, is that the Secure Socket Layer, or SSL, or the S in HTTPS, has a flaw in the actual protocol.
That's not good.
That's not good. That's as many shades of not good as you care to shake a stick at. It's a big deal. Now, the good news is that the OpenSSL people have already issued a fix. So OpenSSL is used by almost all websites, and I think most browsers as well. So OpenSSL is the big one. The biggest result this is going to have on us for now, there's no reports of anyone actually being compromised by this in the wild, so for now it's theoretical. The effect it's going to have on us all is lots and lots of updates to everything that talks to the internet.
You're saying like web browsers would have updates?
Core operating systems. I would expect every operating system to have an update because the operating systems, generally speaking, you'll use the SSL libraries from your operating system. Like IE doesn't have its own SSL libraries, it just uses the libraries in Windows. I'm sure Safari's libraries are used throughout OS X.
Mm-hmm.
The only difference will be Firefox, which uses its own. So expect a Firefox update.
So Firefox update like Tuesday, and one for OS X maybe January?
20 years from now. Yeah, something like that. Expect your IAM clients to possibly need updates as well, depending on whose SSL library they use. If you're running a server, expect Apache. Expect lots of updates, right? It's just, this is going to produce updates because SSL makes everything go. All those secured emails, everything we talked about for regards to the Wi-Fi access point, it's all either SSL or TLS, and they're both affected by this.
So Apple Mail has to be updated?
It may, again, use the libraries that are part of OS X, but anyone running a mail server would probably have to update their mail server. And, I mean, updates. For now, we don't have to worry because there's no actual attacks happening. So, for now, it's just, I have to update stuff.
So,
that may change.
So back to you're happy as long as you see HTTPS No, you can't be happy about that. Okay,
only now you're kind of going.
Okay, so this is to keep it in security light. The answer is when anything that touches the web says, "I want to update right now," say yes.
Exactly, and expect them to expect there to be a glut of updates.
Okay, so Skype and Instant Messenger, all your instant messaging clients, your web browsers, mail, operating system, say yes to everything.
Exactly. We'll see actually how sort of self-contained these things are. It may be a case that if you update OS 10, whenever Apple get around to it, suddenly loads of stuff is fixed.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely expect a Firefox standalone one.
There is an OS 10 update coming. Ken Ray talked about on Mac OS 10 that I'm kind of excited about because it's supposed to address kernel panics because of USB.
Oh, that would be nice.
I would really like to have that one. I don't know if I've mentioned it on the show. I've definitely tweeted about it every time it happens, but fairly, I don't know, maybe a half a dozen times I've plugged in my cinema display via USB and...
Yeah.
So I would like to see that one. That would be really nice.
Yeah, and then isn't it Windows 7's USB drivers cause iTunes to die on certain hardware when you plug in an iPhone?
Yeah, it's really obscure, though. It's like a specific chipset in...
Yeah, it's some Intel like, something 55.
Yeah, that's a really obscure one. So, we should get to our main topic. We've been going 22 minutes so far. We should start up. Let's start.
Yes, so I think I may have mentioned a while ago that I was going to talk about this, but a couple of weeks ago, I sort of finally caved in and bought the Topaz Labs. They have a bundle of plugins, which are... Theoretically, they're Photoshop plugins, which means they work in Photoshop and Photoshop Elements. But I don't own any either Photoshop or Photoshop Elements, but I still bought them because Topaz have made a cool free product called Topaz Fusion that will allow you to run those Photoshop plugins within either Aperture or iPhoto.
Oh, cool.
So once I read that, I was like, oh, cool. And so I did my usual thing. I said, okay, I really want to get Topaz Adjust. So I went to the website and then I went, ooh, and Topaz Detail looks kind of interesting. Ooh, and Topaz Denoise looks kind of good. And before I knew it, I had a shopping list the length of my arm. Oh, look, a bundle. I'll just buy the bundle.
The plugins like this tend to cost a house payment, right?
They can do. These are nowhere near as bad. As plugins go, these are actually reasonable. So the bundle is... Topaz Adjust, Topaz Detail, Topaz Denoise, Topaz Clean, Topaz Simplify, and Topaz DJPEG. And the whole lot came to a little under €100 for me.
Hmm.
Now, the reasons for that are twofold. They had, Topaz themselves had a special offer on. I got a discount code from, Victor pointed me out, it's from Trey Radcliffe's site, Stuck in Customs. It's probably still there. So they had it reduced... they had it reduced to something like $175 from $200 or something to that effect. And then I had a discount code for another 15% off, and then the exchange rate being such meant that the whole lot came in at under €100.
Okay, stop talking about the exchange rate. I'm tired of it.
Yeah, so I think it'll come in at about $150 for Americans.
Every time I tell Bart the temperature, he tells me the exchange rate. So, so
yeah,
for those doing,
you guys have sun, we have cheap dollars.
For those doing the math in their heads, 100 euros is 148 US dollars as of this exact instant in time. So
yeah.
I am really surprised to hear these prices. Every time Robert Lachman talks about it in from photointhemac.com, or photographyinthemac.com, he talks about this amazing plugin that does this one thing that makes somebody's ear look good or something. It'll be $300, you know. So that is a lot cheaper.
Yeah, the Topaz ones are civilized. And in hindsight, I would say if you don't want to spend $150, just buy Topaz Adjust. That's $40.
Hmm. And $50, my kind of dollars.
Is it?
Yeah. I'm looking at a comparison chart right now. So what do these things do?
Okay, so what they do is it's kind of... Topaz Adjust is where it all started. That's their first one, and then the rest are sort of enhancements on Adjust. So Adjust lets you control... it's almost hard to explain, but it has a whole bunch of panels that let you control different things. So in one panel, you can actually do tone mapping. So you can do HDR with it.
Hmm.
With two sliders. So you have much less control than you have in something like Photomatics, where you have about 50 sliders. Well, slight exaggeration, but 20. But here you just have two, which is how much and how you'd like to apply it. And those two sliders are it. And that's kind of nice.
Oh, so reduced control by adding a plug-in. That's kind of interesting.
Well, reduced control compared to an entire standalone app. So plugin versus entire standalone app. I mean,
okay, right.
You know, because you know, if tone mapping isn't something that's part of Aperture or iPhoto.
Ooh, they have a free trial.
I am using Topaz Fusion, by the way, and it works flawlessly. So that's one thing to say.
So wait. So Topaz Adjust, you just told. What's Topaz Fusion do?
Okay.
No, that's the thing that lets you plug it in. That's right.
Yeah. So one of the things Topaz Adjust does is it lets you adjust the exposure, including what they call adaptive exposure, which is in fact tone mapping.
Okay.
Then they let you adjust the color, and they even have something called adaptive saturation, which is kind of like HDR for saturation, which is interesting. They then allow you to do detail enhancement or detail unenhancement, which results in simplifying your photograph. And so you end up with what looks like a drawing of what was a photograph.
Hmm.
So it sucks out detail until you're left with only the core, which is really weird.
I'm looking at some of the pictures on the site, and you hover away onto the photo, and it looks like a normal photo. It just looks kind of plain, and then when you get off of it, all of a sudden it looks like a painting or a drawing. Is that what they're talking about?
Yeah. So, yeah, the hovering thing is just a before and an after.
Right. But it is an interesting effect.
Detail. So if you slide it to the right, you start getting hyper-real detail where it enhances all the edges and really makes it, you know, every detail pops out. And the same slider, if you slide it to the left, it starts to suck away detail from the image and simplify it.
Interesting.
Which is weird.
Yeah.
But potentially quite neat. And then it also does some noise reduction just for the hell of it. So actually, depending on what you want to do, you can. There's a million different outcomes just from Topaz Adjust. And then where the other plugins come from is that they take the ideas of Topaz Adjust, individual ideas, and they improve, they give you more control. So Topaz Detail takes that one detail slider and breaks it out into an entire plugin with lots of control. So you can control the detail at large scales, medium scales, and small scales. You can control sort of how the sharpening algorithm is added so that you can make sure you get no haloing or no nasty effects. So the Topaz Detail plugin basically expounds on that one slider in Topaz Adjust and gives you way more control. So if you find that you really like that, but you'd like more control, well, that's what Topaz Detail is for. Topaz Denoise, it's obvious enough, it just gives you lots and lots of sliders for controlling how it sucks out the noise. And it's actually quite impressive how well it can suck out noise, because the Nikon D40, bit of a noise generator in low light.
So, but you don't take a lot of indoor shots. I'd be surprised that you needed to denoise very often.
I take lots of shots during sunset and stuff.
Ah, okay.
And low light make D40 unhappy. Really unhappy. And the other thing is I like tone mapping stuff, and what tone mapping does is it multiplies noise. So it tries to find detail to bring out, and if it finds noise, it says, oh, look, detail. It brings out the detail.
Okay.
In fact, that's probably what I've ended up sort of settling into using Topaz Adjust for is I would bring a photo into Photomanix and realize that it was unusable because of the noise. Just could not use it at all using Photomanix. And then I'd bring it into Topaz Adjust and use that adaptive exposure slider and do a pretty damn good job of tone mapping it, and it will suck out the noise. So I was able to rescue shots that would have simply thrown in the bin.
Yeah. I'm looking at this online. Again, if you guys go to the topazlabs.com site, you can, as you're listening to this, we probably should have said at the beginning, but as you're describing it, it really helps. I'm looking at these and going, oh, look what that does.
The other cool one, because I shot for a long time on JPEG. You've done a lot of work on JPEG. If you end up with an image that has JPEG artifacting in it, Topaz DJPEG sort of tries to get rid of that horrible blockiness and gives your images back their more natural look. Like, especially in the sky, if you start to do too much processing on a JPEG, you'll end up with those blockiness and sort of banding in the sky and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, Topaz DJPEG should suck that out.
How does it do that without blurring?
It applies sensible blurs, because that's kind of what you want.
Right.
You want blur on the bits that are blocky, but not everywhere else.
Not in the other parts, yeah. So what he's talking about, in particular, you tend to see it around the edges of things if you've over-JPEG'd it. I don't ever see that in my photos today. I mean, if you go, you know, super high compression on it or something, you'll see it. Or, you know, it's a poor quality photo to start with. But I don't see those JPEGs at all, or I wouldn't be using it.
I have it in a couple of my older shots, and it really annoys me. Irish skies seem to have so many shades of blue in them that they tend to really confuse JPEGs, and JPEG goes, oh, I'll just compress this down.
Okay.
You don't need all of these values in here, and then you know, with these horrible
blue is blue,
skies.
Bart. Move on.
Yeah, no, in Ireland it isn't. Like, they talk about all the shades of green we have. We have as many shades of blue in that sky of ours as well.
Green, that's not a color I'm familiar with outdoors.
What's this green you speak of?
We're really good at brown out here. If it's green, it wouldn't catch on fire, so what fun would that be? All right, what's next in the list?
Well, to be honest, they're the only ones I've really found a use for. Topaz okay. Simplify is like that removing of detail. So it's sort of Topaz Detail and Topaz Simplify are both extensions of that detail slider in Topaz Adjust, if I haven't lost everyone.
Okay.
So Topaz Simplify is for making those painterly-like things, which I have zero interest in whatsoever.
Okay.
I mean, some people may be able to do fantastically creative things with Topaz Simplify. Yeah, it's just not what I'm interested in.
So the main reason you like Topaz Adjust is to do the HDR?
Yeah. What I found is I take a low-light shot, I try to do it in Photomanix, it doesn't work, so then I use Topaz Adjust.
Hmm. Well, I never did get around to doing Topaz or getting Photomatix, and I've just started shooting some raw photos just because you've worn me down. So maybe I should give that a try. I am working on my Christmas list right now.
Yeah, well, Topaz Adjust, I would advise people, if money is tight, don't do what I did and buy them all. Don't be tempted. Just buy Topaz Adjust. And if you start to say to yourself, do you know, I really like detail enhancement, or I really like that painterly look, then go and buy Topaz Clean or Topaz Simplify or Topaz Detail.
But just that way you're only buying a couple of them.
Yeah, I would imagine that the average person is only going to need about 3 or 4 of these, even in an ideal world where they had everything they wanted.
But $50 a piece.
But they're not all $50.
Oh, okay.
So I did the math and I decided there were 4 of them I was interested in, and I decided that it was cheaper to buy the bundle. But to be honest, Topaz Clean, I haven't figured out what the point is, because I don't have... I guess if I had a lot of problem where I had old images I was scanning in or something that needed to be sort of have blotches and things taken off, it probably would be great for that, but I haven't found the need. And Topaz Simplify is just something I have zero interest in whatsoever. So those two I just have not used.
Okay. But for you, that was worth it for you.
Hmm?
It was worth it for you for the ones that you needed then. That's good.
It was, yeah. And I have to say, Topaz Adjust has just blown me away. I didn't think I'd use it as much as I am, and I didn't think I'd like it as much as I do.
Well, cool. That's one you've been promising to tell me about for a long time, and I did want to understand what that was, because as soon as you said plug-in, I ran screaming from the room, grabbing my checkbook to my chest.
Yeah, and in fairness, we should probably mention that Robert Lockman has been going on about how great Topaz Adjust is for, like, ever.
Ah, okay. I must have missed him actually talking about something reasonably priced.
You just heard, saw the word plug-in and blanked it from your mind.
I probably did. That was probably it. Well, this is great. Anything else on this?
Let me just check my notes here, but no, I think that's pretty much it. As I said, my biggest bit of advice is start with probably just get Topaz Adjust. And because it'll work in iPhoto and Aperture, that's kind of the big thing here.
Right.
And you have to go hunting on their website a bit for Topaz Fusion, but it is there and it is free.
Okay, good. And they do, the cool thing, I just noticed they have free 30-day trials, so I may give that a try and see whether it's worth putting on my Christmas list.
Oh, I didn't notice the 30-day trials. I probably should have done that. But there you go. I'm a bit impulsive sometimes.
Really?
Sorry, I guess.
All right, Bart. Well, this has been a good segment, even though we had a lot of security stuff. But I like the recap stuff too. It's kind of nice to close that up and tie it in a bow.
Yeah, exactly. And we get such great feedback from people. We should mention it.
Definitely. All right. We'll. I think we're on schedule for next week.
Assuming my chest is still within my body, assuming my lungs still work. Yes. So, until next time, happy computing.
Well, thanks for joining us again this week. Keep up all the dumb questions, comments, and complaints if you must, and send in your audio reviews by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. If you join the live chat over at podfeet.com/live around 5 p.m. GMT minus 8 on Sunday nights, be sure to send me your Twitter name so I can add you to the NoSillaCast live Twitter list. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.